This speaker tonight, for those of you who are here for your very first roundup, you're in for a real treat. Those who are repeats are certainly going to be pleased. I had the privilege of listening to this great lady's tape a couple of times before she came into town. And the first time I listened through it, I had it in the car, and so I heard part of it on the way to work and another part of it at lunch, and then I was on my way to a client meeting, and I swear I've got tears rolling down my eyes listening to her story as I'm getting out of my car to go to this appointment with a client. And this client sees me and says, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm fine. Allergies." It's a really great story, though. And to top it all off, just to make the day complete, I had the honor of picking this person up and escorting her here and spending a little time with her. And without any further ado, I'd like to introduce our one-winged angel, Sharon B. from Los Angeles.
My name is Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
and Dick promised me a whole pitcher under here. He first said I had a half a glass, and I went, "Don't tease me." So I do have a whole pitcher of water. So thank you, Dick, and thank you for all the phone calls. And God, Atlanta, it's good to be back. I love your elegance. I love, was it Santa Claus up here talking to us? And all the rules, if it's your first conference, just follow along, and obviously you're not going to be bored here this weekend. There's a lot to do, and there's anybody, just ask anybody and follow along, because there's energy in this room, there's life in this room, and the people in this room aren't boring. So you will not be bored. So grab hold and just hang on. 25 years of anything is consistency, and John and the gentleman over here, been 25 years in a row, and that says something to me. That says something about what you have in this town. Thank you, Doug, for picking me up. He was easy to spot. He had a bottle of something in his hand, and so always easy to spot. And this elegant lady sitting over here with a broken leg or broken foot, she's all very elegant looking, and she's got all these polished nails and a toe ring. I just think we're always full of surprises, so you can dress us up, but we don't know about taking us anywhere. But it's great to be here, and I have a couple of women I sponsor here, and friends and people I've met before, and Susan's handkerchief from her grandmother, that just special connections. And I'm going on my 25th year, because of good sponsorship and a God, loving God, and people who have prayed for me, friends, family, and strangers. I've been sober since August 20th, 1975. So just as you were starting your roundup, I was laying on a gurney, actually, by this time. What memories. just getting ready for you. It took a little bit for me. I'm a little hard-headed. So, life as I knew it was about to change, and I had no idea that it was about to change in such a dramatic way. We're in the room, we have the gift, and that's what I always like to remember, is that the gift has been given if you're in the room. Now, what you do with the gift is up to you. And I certainly didn't want to start my life over in Alcoholics Anonymous, but looking back, it's such a blessing that I got the chance to know Alcoholics Anonymous, because many alcoholics will never get a chance to be in the rooms. And I don't know if I have one shot in and out of the door, or eight or nine, or I know that this is it for me today, and I'm going to try to make it stick, because the woman that was the first one I saw with the big book didn't make it. She had seven chances, and on her eighth chance, she didn't get back. She died at 31 years old. And the last time I was here, Robert and I went for a ride to see a lady that helped me very much in my early days of sobriety. I found her living somewhere in Atlanta, and we reminisced old times, and she had the bottles put away for the day, I could tell, and she was shaking it out, but she was sober that day to see me again. And she helped me a lot when I was new, and she hadn't been able to stay sober. And I went and visited with her and showed her pictures of my son and what had gone on in my life. And that year, it was such a blessing that we found her and were able to do that, because that year the Christmas card came back stamped deceased. I never, I don't know how many chances she had in and out, but she had a few. So if you're here, you've got the gift. And a speaker when I was very new named Norm Alpe used to talk about seconds and inches. And we're the lucky ones that we got to be here, that we, as alcoholics, know that there's a way for us to go. I always think of Matt Talbot on a rainy night because he was this Irish guy that had the disease of alcoholism prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. He wasn't born in a time and frame where he could go down the street or look it up in the directory or the local paper or pick up the phone. There was no Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was an alcoholic, and he knew that he suffered from the disease of the grape. And so when he'd feel his mouth frothing, he'd have his friends tie him to a tree, chain him to a tree. It took a chain. And they would chain him to a tree, and he would go through all kinds of weather, sometimes 3, 4, 5 days. And then they would unchain him when he would stop, you know, his cravings. That's the way he dealt with his alcoholism. And I always think of these rainy nights, all of us out there chained to trees, you know. You wouldn't be whining about the coffee or the speaker then, you know. It's like, just get me to a seat. I'll take any seat, you know. So that we're born in this time and frame of Alcoholics Anonymous where it's just so abundant and it's so right down the street. Just grab hold and make your life worth something. It's, you know, your gift back to God is what you do with this gift. And so I always want to remember that. It's a privilege to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a privilege on a daily basis. I was born in Iowa, and that was my first resentment, and I just came back from speaking there and last weekend, and my mother sat in the room for the very first time, and I really prayed about this before, and she said, "Oh, I've heard you talk," which she hadn't, but I think she had heard some tapes of me. And but she was in the room, and it was a very healing, loving, wonderful experience, but I don't think I could have done it 1 year sooner. Because, you know, we just tear people up. They don't know what's wrong with us. I'm from a non-alcoholic family. Nobody knew what was going on with me. They just, you know, sometimes I wonder if I was from Zeke the Mailman. There were all these kids born in the valley right in the same summer, and we all kind of had these same blue eyes, you know, children of the damned eyes. And it's been Zeke the Mailman because, you know, a lot of us have alcohol problems, and nobody else in my family has or since. And but I always had that loud head and that just, God, guilty. If you, somebody took something from, you know, a pencil was missing, it was like, oh my God, it must be on me somewhere. You know, I always felt like I should have done something, or I missed it, or they gave out the rules and I was not there that day. But I was real good at faking it. We're real good at faking it. I was. And so I became, you know, bigger than my feelings at a really early age. And I don't remember really a lot of drinking going on. There were parties and New Year's Eves and Czechoslovakian weddings that went on for days, it seemed like. But, you know, there was no real craziness. There was just a lot of fun, and it was a community, and people took care of each other. And if your house burned down, they were there building it the next day. People had a sense of community, a sense of value, and they cared about each other genuinely. And that's what I was raised with. And somewhere along the line in alcoholism, you know, we draw those lines in the sand, and if I ever cross that line, then, you know, maybe I should go to a psychiatrist, or maybe I should maybe try Valium therapy. But, you know, as I went down my disease of alcoholism, I became such a taker. I became so closed off. I said things like, "I'm not hurting anybody but myself, so leave me alone." I mean, that is the height of being selfish and self-centered. You know, just sit there and watch me die. I'm not hurting anybody but me. And it was the 60s when I got out of high school, and it was just say thanks, not just say no. And we had a lot of fun. A lot going on there. And I'm a middle child. I come into the room with my fists up to prove myself. It's just the way I am. And, you know, I have this older sister that's a Mensa, and she's wonderful, and a younger sister that wanted at 2 to be a nurse and moved to Alaska. She moved to Alaska, and she's a nurse. And then my brother, who's the youngest, and I was just that middle child, and I always felt rebellious, and I had to prove myself, and I had to do a little extra. And, you know, I was drinking by this time. I started drinking in high school, and it just fit. It fit. It fit me from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes. It was a spiritual experience for me. It shut off my head. It made me whole. You know, I was always, they pinned the corsage on me, and just this last weekend, and as I've gone on in life, there's been a little bit of activity, but when I was, you know, younger, I had these little kind of little bumps, and they would I remember going to the prom and Janet Andrews would have this like rack and the corsage would just sit there so nice, you know, and my corsages would like droop and fall down. And I always loved the guy. I fell in love with the guy that would buy me the wrist corsage. I just thought, oh. But you know, when I had alcohol, those little bumps stood up. Marilyn Monroe happened. It was just, you know, who needs Janet Andrews? Step aside, Marilyn's here, you know. And I just, it filled me up. It made me whole. It made me not care. It made me fun. It made that head shut up. You know, everybody up there in that head, that yakety, 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 yak. I had insomnia as a child, and yakety, yakety, yak. They all got drunk. They just got drunk. It was great. And then in the 60s, going to college, there was a lot going on. I tried to go to those classes to be a school teacher. I tried to join the sorority. I went off to the Democratic Convention in Chicago. I went as a nice little sorority girl, and by the time that weekend was over, I was marching with Dick Gregory to Mayor Daley's house. You know? Smoking my pot, drinking my matus, waving at everybody with one finger. You know? I was never to put on a Bobby Brooks matching skirt and sweater set again, and matching patent leather shoes and a little bag, and those days were over. And my parents began to wonder what was wrong with me, and I did things like wake them up in the middle of the night to change my name. I thought it was important. You know, it was important enough to drive from the university, to wake them up, to get them at the kitchen table, to sit them down and go, share, S-H-A-R-E. Because I share and share alike. And, you know, my father just flexed his jaw and looked at what I had drug home I'm sharing with, you know. The eyes spinning, the bare feet, you know, nodding his head. And my mother would just go, oh, Sharon, and she would go off to bed. And I was like, this was important. It was a breakthrough for me. You know, it was a big breakthrough. But things started to turn. I had my heart broken. And you know how we are when we have broken hearts. Oh, I didn't cry. My mother said, aren't you going to cry? And I said, no. And I went and drank a six-pack of beer, actually it was Colt 45, and I went down and found that guy to tell him what I thought about how he was being tutored by what I saw being tutored. They were having a tutor class under the lights of this sorority house, and she was teaching him things I hadn't taught him yet. And so I went down to tell him what I thought about it, and I was drunk and swinging at him, and he took my arm and he twisted it behind me and put me on the floor so that I would stop trying to hit him. And I thought, no man's ever going to treat me like that again, ever, ever, ever. And I just hardened my heart. And as I went down the road of alcoholism, by the time I was 22, 23 years old, I was living in relationships where black eye, knife fights, you know, that line in the sand, no man's ever going to treat me like that, had just kind of been erased and moved down a little bit. And it was absolutely normal for me to live in that kind of a relationship, and I didn't grow up with any of that. Alcoholism will take everything you are and just wring it out and replace it in the middle of the night with darkness and just someone you don't even know, but you accept it. I accepted every piece of my life as it came to me with my alcoholism because I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just knew I loved alcohol. I loved everything about it. I built my life around King Alcohol, as it talks about in the book, because I gave up my creative ability. I gave up a potential marriage, and you know, maybe it was a pig farm in Iowa, maybe that was a blessing, I don't know, but you know, I gave up a lot. I gave up a college education, I gave up my musical ability, I gave up a lot along the way. And I don't know if I was sitting in a bar in one of the geographics I had taken, New York City, West End Bar, on meeting with my phrenologist, who I met with every Friday afternoon, the guy with the turban in the back of the room. You know, it was shining white, and he would come and read the bumps on my head and tell me if anything new had gone on in this last week of my life. But I'd buy him drinks, so he'd sit there and he'd tell me whatever I wanted to hear. And, you know, I don't know if the bartender would have said, you know, Sharon, if you drink and act like that tonight, you're not going to paint another picture for 30 years. And I had artistic ability. I had an artistic nature. I could paint pictures. I could bring joy to the world with what I could put on a canvas. I would have said, who cares? Double it. You know, pour it, just double it. I don't want to hear about that. I want this. Alcohol was more important than that. And I don't know, you know, living in Aspen, Colorado, and sitting next to Bob Dylan, you know, and the bartender would have said, you know, if you drink like this and act like this, there goes your dignity. Last piece of your dignity. You're going to have to pay for that with the last piece of your dignity. I go, take it. Go. Dignity. Who cares about dignity? You know, double that fill that rock glass to the top with Jose Cuervo gold and buy him one too. You know, just buy him one too, and who cares about dignity? Alcohol, king alcohol in my life was much more powerful than who I was or what I had to offer the world, my gifts that I was born with. Alcohol was beginning to take from me, and I was giving it freely, and I was getting bitter, and I was becoming the victim. You didn't know how I was going to act. Most of the time, I had my thumb out and the wind at my back and a dog at my heels and my book in my backpack called Be Here Now by Baba Ram Dass. I knew nothing about being here now. If you're on about 16 four-way hits of that Orange Sunshine stuff, you might find truth briefly, but it melts before you can write it down, you know? It's like I was on this search for truth. I had done some things like cut my wrist. My father came down to college to talk to me. I was cleaning a pound of pot on the table. It was hard to hide that. And, you know, the priest was with him. The priest and I got drunk that night. And it was, I tried going back to the Catholic Church. I had a huge fight within the confessional with one of the... We started talking politics. And that's when I started taking my geographics. And it just seemed like me and Dad couldn't sit in the room and have a conversation because I just saw the disappointment in his eyes. And I wanted him to fix it. Dad, you got the big shoulders. You're the patriarch of this family. Everybody else seems to be doing fine. Dad, just fix it. And he was there, and he tried. You know, we did the doctor. We did the psychiatrist. We did the Catholic Church. We did a lot of the stuff. And I was so arrogant and shut down and selfish and self-centered, and alcohol just, it just fueled it. It just guarded me from anything good. It just left me inside of me. I could handle me. And the further I went down the road, it was just me. It was just me. I didn't, you know, sure, I had a lot of fun acquaintances and I had a lot of friends, but I didn't let anybody into that darkness. It was too sad and sorry how I felt about myself. And that shouldn't be. That you know, we are God's kids. That shouldn't be. And that's what alcohol will do. It will take away every piece of you. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I just knew that I was on this path, and I kept moving. I kept taking those geographics. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard Norm Alpe say, the reason the grass was greener is because the other guy took care of his lawn. And I went, oh, that's why. I've been waiting there. Oh, I want to sit on your dichondra lawn, you know. I don't want to sit on my barren lawn. And so I've been tilling my soil here for almost 25 years now and you know, weeding and blooming and growing and changing and letting you plant and sitting in my weeds and sometimes getting on the edge of my garden, but always living within my skin sober, you know, every piece of it. And there's a lot of joy in that, knowing that when I put my head on the pillow at night, I know about today. Whether it was a good day or a bad day, it was a great day because I was sober, and that gratitude has allowed me to have an incredible passion for living life. Because when I came to you, it was over. There was deadness in my eyes, and it had been there for a while. There was no light left in me. Ended up in California with Bob Dylan. I came to a commune. I danced with the Krishnas on my 21st birthday. I got almost dunked in Laguna Beach, and everybody wanted my soul forever, or they wanted an eternity thing, or a commitment from me, or come with them and change your name and leave your worldly possessions. Like, I live a day at a time. See you guys. You know, when I came to you and I found out it was a day at a time, it was like I kind of paid attention a little bit, because that's the way I lived. I lived one moment, one day at a time. The commune asked me to leave because I was a little bit depressing for them, and I ended up back in Colorado, and I went to get my things back, and I couldn't ask for them back in this cabin. This guy was standing there in my dashiki. He had my favorite coffee cup in his hand. You know, he was cooking with my pots and pans, sleeping on my sheets. And I said, excuse me, there's some photographs. Oh, yeah, okay, you can have those. And I didn't say, you know, those are mine. I want them back. I couldn't do it. And I thought, what's wrong with you? And I ended up at the Mountain Man Bar drinking that night, of course, and passing out in the shuffleboard and the sawdust and hitchhiking my way back to Mom and Dad. I'm 21, and my mother says, you can stay here, Sharon, but please don't disrupt the family. Don't take any drugs in this house. And please leave your father alone, because you two just, I don't know what it is about you two. Just don't get in his way. And you can stay here for a while. And I was sick. I didn't know what was wrong with me. Nobody knew it was alcoholism. And I drank in those local taverns, and I was really ill. I knew I was dying, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I absolutely knew I was dying. And I didn't talk to anybody about it. I just drank. And I was depressed and lonely. And my dog was killed. And It was January, and so we put her in the trunk of my car, and I guess my mother thought I was going to bury her or something, and she was there a week or two later when I was drunk, sitting on the trunk of my car talking to Tar Baby, and my mother came out and saw this scene, you know, and I'm just, like, drunk talking to this dead, stiff dog, and she got a little worried about me then. But they didn't know alcoholism, and when I went to my grandmother's that Thanksgiving, they sat me with the children at the card tables. They didn't know to put me with the adults, and they didn't know if I was going to, you know, vomit in the turkey or pass out on somebody or say something nasty or you know, sob uncontrollably, because I would do that occasionally. And I knew that I wasn't a part of that family anymore. And I ended up in northern Wisconsin, an organic farm, because somebody said they'd take care of me. You know, I just didn't know it was going to be a lot of work, or I might not have gone. That organic farming living is a lot of work, but there were a bunch of organic people up there, and so they took away my cigarettes, they took away my alcohol, and they gave me organic pot to smoke. And I thought, well, yeah, that's okay for a while, but, you know, they had these little glasses of organic dandelion wine, and they would sit around and have hootenannies and eat brown rice and collard greens and, you know, all this weird stuff, and I just get thirstier. You know, I'd smoke this pot from morning to night, and it just didn't do it. And I would go into this little town called Connersville and put my quarters down, because I was painting mailboxes. That's what I did. That was my job, to paint mailboxes for a living. And shovel sheep things, organic sheep stuff. And I get this wine, and I come home, and I just feel better. You know, the cat looked happier, the dog looked happier. You know, his banjo playing didn't bother me anymore. And I would get roaring drunk. And when I got drunk now, it was like the mouth slipped to the side, the cowboy boots came on. You know, Pete Seeger went across the room, the Rolling Stones went on, cranked it up. And me and my wine and the cat and the dog, you know, we just had a great time. And it was like, could take a deep breath again. And he got up and looked at me once about 3 or 4 in the morning when I was having a good time, and he gave me that look, that Al-Anon look, that kind of stern, judgmental look. You know, it took me a long time, because I've been on the other end of that look, and I realized it's a look of confusion. You know, just, what are you doing with your life? And there's some compassion in it too, but I read it as a judgment, and I thought, my head, loud and clear, said alcohol is more fun than you. And I made a decision to get out, and it took me a while to get out, but I did finally. Actually, they blackballed me from their community, and I had a half acre of organic pot, which I tended to with my wine, and my friend Clarence would bring the hard stuff up the lane at night, because I couldn't afford it, but he would come bring the hard stuff. And Clarence had too many DWIs, so he was on a tractor. They had taken away his license, so... And some nights he put in his teeth, and some nights he didn't put in his teeth, but, you know. I had this pink piano. I had painted this upright, and we would play Indian love songs, and I'd sob, and, oh, God, drink his gin. And then his wife took away the keys to the tractor, I think, and I never saw him again. But I harvested my pot, went into town to do this big dope deal, and I had left the hefty bags of the marijuana back at the farm, so... I joined the carnival because it was there, and it was that simple. I'm sure you would have done it, too. I mean, it was just the next thing out of town. It was an answer. I put the pot in the station wagon. I told my new current dog to get in, painted a big sun on the hood, named my car Cheshire, and we joined the carnival. And, you know, they had an opening. What can I say? And I have my tequila, and I'm running a shooting gallery. My tequila's underneath, and the dog's out front, and pretty soon I'm getting nasty, and the dog's even getting nasty. And I'd like to do things like start fights and stand back and watch. And I called my mother from Arkansas and said, Mom, guess what? It's like, oh, she started crying on the phone. My mom was always one of my champions. Mom and I have always had a really kind of good relationship, and when to hear her cry now was like, you know, my dad and I, it had been over for a long time. We couldn't sit at the same table and have breakfast. And we couldn't ride in the same car together. We couldn't be in the same room together, because the emotional pain between me and my dad was so thick. It was so painful to even be around. And now my mom's crying, and my mother had to go back to that farm and take care of the cat, and the horse was out, and the sheep were out, and her antiques if she wanted them back. But I'm not hurting anyone but myself, and I'm just writing another chapter in my book, Mom, and you'll be okay, don't worry about it. And somewhere down in Louisiana, I guess I had started one too many fights on the Midway, and the owner of the show got a little mad at me, and one morning I opened the door at 6 a.m., I should have known, and it was Franklinton Parish Finest, with shotguns, and they stuck it in my belly and stood me up against the cheap motel. And they searched the room, and they found enough for sales and possession. And I tried to tell them it was just for my own use, but it was enough for sales. So off I went, and off the dog went, and off my new friend went. And he had a pet skunk named Crank, and so off Crank went. We all ended up in a Bogalusa, Louisiana lockup. And the carnival left town. Nobody came to see if I was okay. I was like, do you want a magazine, cigarettes? Can we get you a lawyer? No, nothing. And I couldn't believe this had happened to me. And they would come by and they would say, that's a skunk lady. And I went crazy. I found the guy that was making something out of apple and sugar. And if you held your nose and got it down, you got a buzz. And the roaches were as big as my thumb. And it was pretty crazy in there. And after being there about a week, they said I had a visitor, and they put handcuffs on me, threw me in the car, and they drove me somewhere and threw me in this room, and there was my father. And I'll tell you, Dad didn't want to see me looking like that and in that predicament, and I didn't want to see him. And it took me until 8 years ago to ask my father about that day. See, we don't run out and make amends, you know, like work with your sponsor, work through the steps, you know, get to those points. And I asked my dad about that day because I didn't remember it. And he said, I said, you know, what did I say, Dad? He said, you told me you weren't guilty. It wasn't your fault. That was never my fault. I had a list a mile long as to why I was in the jackpot I was in. And my dad hired this lawyer, and I went back to jail for another 21 days or so. I was in there about 31 days. And then they let me out and said I was going to have to go pay this fine. And so I better go to work and don't leave the state. And I found the French Quarter of New Orleans, and I fell in love. And it was just a terrific place to have King Alcohol be in your life, because I built my life around. I danced on Bourbon Street. I wore fishnet stockings, outfits with zippers, platinum blonde wigs. I had drag queen friends that would make me up, and I loved to walk down to work with that skunk on its little rhinestone leash. And I thought people were looking at me going, look at her, there she is, there's Cher, you know? S-H-A-R-E, mind you. But they weren't. They were like getting out of my way, because a few years ago I was down in the French Quarter, and a friend of mine is the manager, Pat O'Brien's, and he's sober. And so Casey and I went upstairs, and we stood above. It was Labor Day. They call it Decadence Weekend. And we stood above looking down on Bourbon Street and watching, and all of a sudden the crowd starts to part. You know, we're looking, and here comes this leather, whips and chains, kind of big hair, all different colors, you know, kind of coming out of everywhere, girl. And they're all like, and I see her, and they both look at me, and it was like, come on, you guys, come on. But I look at her, and I know her. She's walking down the street with everything she's got, and she thinks the crowd is just parting to say hello to her and to greet her. But they're like going, oh my God, and they're taking out their cameras and taking pictures. And I just went, oh, but for the grace of God, seconds and inches, you know. But I did this for a while, and we lived above a biker bar, and I was with this guy with a skunk, Mr. Skunk Man, because, you know, he got busted too. We're in this thing forever, and we have to pay this big fine or do time. And we live above this biker bar called the Mousetrap Bar. And the last time my mom and dad came to visit me was when I was living there, and it was a tar paper roof apartment. We were the third apartment in. The first one was a guy who worked and lived downstairs, and he'd drive his bike up the stairs into his apartment. The second one was a girl named Angela who worked nights, let's just say. And then there was me and the skunk man and the skunk and the dog, and now by now we have a snake. And I came to the door, and there's my mom and dad. They had been in Texas. They thought they'd try to come over and find me, and they found me. And I had my wig on and a new black eye, and this guy put the snake in my dad's face upon meeting him and calling me four-letter words in front of my mother. And that's about what I remember that day. And I do remember when they left that day that I wanted to just crawl in the back seat and go back home with them, because I was tired. I was so tired. but my arrogance wouldn't let me, and I knew nothing would change. And they went home that day, and I found out last year my sister and brother were there, and I didn't even remember seeing them. I was drinking tequila most of the time. I was taking anything that I could take to keep me up so unless I passed out flat, I couldn't stand to go to bed. Sometimes I'd go to the Bastille and I would come to and wake up, come to and pass out and just be there for 2 days. I would just be there for 2 days because Billy was I became a bartender. He'd come to my bar, he had a tab, I had a tab at his bar, he'd put my purse underneath and it would be okay. And then I made him mad once and I walked in and he went out, and I found out later I had broken the ceiling fan. I guess my hair got caught in it. I don't really remember the evening. But even the Bastille, which was one of those not on your tourist spot kind of places, you know, he's gone out. And I ended up tending bar in Lower Decatur Street. I worked my way down to Lower Decatur Street where you could smell the bathroom when you came to the front door. And I got fired for having a bad attitude working there. Then this relationship of 2 years, parole got pulled. That should say it right there. They found him and he moved back to St. Louis, and I got in my car, went out and moved there. And I finally found him, and he got off his Harley, took off his helmet, and he crashed it through, and he pulled me through by my hair, and he said, if I ever see you again, I will kill you. And St. Louis police pulled up at that moment, or it would have been a different ending to that story. And that's the way I let go of that relationship. You know, I didn't just be happy he left town. That's the way I let go. I don't let go until it's time to let go. I have this insane, intense... My second sponsor, Ginny, said, you remind me of this girl that used to walk around the meeting that had this thing in her hand all the time, and she would put it in her pocket, and she was kind of crazy, but you know, one day she trusted me enough to let me look to see what this gem in her hand was she was holding, and I looked in, and it was a dried up old turd. I said, well, thank you very much. I remind you of that lady, okay. See, I'm a loyal Leo to a fault, and I stood up tall inside myself, and I looked at her, and I said, I know, but it was my turd. It belonged to me. You know? And that's the way I felt about it. This guy was the only thing I had. He was the only thing I had that made me feel a little bit alive. And it was not healthy or good or anything that you wanted for even your worst enemy, that kind of relationship. But I finally let go. I came back to New Orleans and I went to Florida, moved in a blackout, and things weren't good. 1975, my friend Michael was shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day. I was 2 feet inside the door in a blackout. If I would have been 2 feet to the left, you'd have another speaker. I would be framed in black on my mother's piano at home. And they would go, God, that was daughter number two. She had such spark. We don't know what happened to her. And I was 2 feet inside the door, and I ended up leaving town, because I found something in the apartment. My friend, who was on the police force, said, look, I can get you out of town. Go away. So I went to New York, and I drank, and I ended up coming to California. I was writing a book. I was with some people writing a book on American Indian arts and crafts. We were at every bar there was. One has died of alcoholism, the other I can't find, and I was the bad drinker of the bunch. They kept saying, God, you're just so maudlin. What is wrong with you? I mean, sometimes you didn't know I played George Jones on the jukebox over and over for the good times. That was the greatest song in the world. Or one of my favorite gin drinking partners would play my favorite victim song, which was You Made Me Love You. You know, it's like, oh, play it again, Sam, you know, over and over and over again. And they would say, just why do you have to act like that? Can't you just control your drinking a little bit? And I would say, you know, if you wouldn't have bought that thrifty vodka last night, I would be feeling better today. Shut up, you know. And we went to Barney's Beanery, and that's where I first saw the Big Book, was this bar in West Hollywood. And this girl was so drunk that the bartender had to call her a cab to take her to A&A. He wouldn't let her drive. And so she went off to A&A with this black and white book. It was the second edition. And I remember thinking, you know, she should turn the cover around on that thing or something, you know. But we all gave her a toast out the door. Chris, good for you. Go to A&A, you know. And that's the girl that was my Eskimo to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the woman that had seven ins and outs, and on the eighth one she didn't get back. And I don't know if God would say, Chris, you got seven times. Make one stick. Hang on. Hang on to the seat. My sponsor used to have me hang on to the seat with my hands because I'm a runner. I don't know if you got that, but I am a runner. She would say, take your hands and hang on to the seat. The feeling will pass. I had never heard that before. The feeling will pass. And I, yeah, right. You know, and I did everything to prove the sponsor wrong. I followed her instructions to the letter so that I could call her up and say, you were wrong. And not once have I ever done that with a sponsor, because between me and my sponsor's air. Between me and me is me, and they're loud up there. You know, I think I got them figured out. They change clothes in the middle of the night, then I don't know who to do. So I just kind of send them to the back of the bus. I don't feed them any tuna fish sandwiches. They kind of starve and wither up, you know. And me and God are at the front of the bus, and I let God drive, you know. But they're always there. That's my alcoholism. Centers in the mind. I just send them to the back of the bus. I turn it down like a bad radio station. And some days they're loud, and I need you, you know. And I need that sponsor that knows what's going on in my life, because I need a sponsor louder than my head. It has worked for me every time. But Janet was, you know, she was right, and I would hang on to that seat, and if the feeling did pass, you know, and she'd say, you know, have a day, and some days it's just, come on midnight, you know, just make it till midnight. And I'm a runner. I don't sit through feelings. If I have an emotion about it, I've got to go. It's too intense for me. I got to have a drink, or I got to go. I could never just be still and know that there's God or life or hope. You know, when hope gets up and walks out of your life, I don't know where you're sitting or what you're doing, something changes. It gets darker. And you drink a long time with that darkness. And I drank a long time with hope gone out of my life. And I came back to New Orleans. And I had alcoholic stuttering. I remember getting off the plane and not realizing until I had some drinks, could I talk even? And these people that I loved and cared about me didn't want to be around me anymore. They didn't let me have my old job back where they had fired me. I begged for that job back at that stinking little bar. And they didn't want me back. And I ended up meeting a guy going to Texas and going through Texas, and he was going to Hawaii, and I ended up having DTs in Texas, and I scared him, and I think I ended up at Barney's Beanery again, and he left money on the bar, and I never saw him again. And somebody said, you know, we're going to go party in Palm Springs. Do you want to go? And I said, sure, and I got on the back of a Harley because I love bikes. I loved being near the edge. I just liked it because I could come alive a little bit. And so I liked that the faster we went, the better I could feel like I was alive. And so they left me there, and they just needed a little extra weight on the back tire. It was windy going through the desert. So I was over 170 pounds of red dashiki Panama hat, walking Sunset Boulevard, unemployable, broken in every way, but arrogant and feisty, and I'm still swinging. You know, I'm still swinging. And that's the beauty of our surrenders that got us in the door, that moment of truth, wherever you had it, whenever you had it, it's a precious gift. It's so precious that I hope I never, ever forget it. Because what happened was I ended up with some people I didn't know. They took me somewhere. They abused me. They broke my jaw in three places. They physically tore me up and threw me off the side of the road. July 27th, 1975. So on July 28th, I was laying in a gurney because the gardener had found me, because I had gotten up, because I was laying in that desert. I heard a voice, and the voice said, get up, I want to live. And it was not me. It was not me that said that. I was ready to go. I was 25, and I was ready to go. And I ended up being found by a gardener that early morning, and I was in the hospital being prepped for surgery, and I heard that voice again. Now, I had had a concussion, and that I was in and out, but I heard the voice laying on the gurney. You know, these guys didn't do this to you. It's not your father's fault. It's not your sister, the Mensa, George, who broke your heart at 18, and it went through my list of mea culpas. You did this to you. But you did this to you. I'm finally hearing truth. I don't know what to do with it. I'm hearing it. And I laid in the hospital. I was in there for 2 weeks, and I had a birthday. And they came in, and they felt sorry for me, and they brought me a little glass of wine. And I had all these wires on my face, and I stuck a straw through the wires where the tooth had been and put it in this little glass of wine, and I started to have some wine. I waited for him to leave so I could really enjoy this wine. So I had been on the morphine button for about a week and a half, and something happened that had never happened to me before. I was repulsed by the taste of the wine. I don't know where that came from. I drank, you know, cigarette butts, cockroaches, take them out and throw it down. You know, it didn't matter. And now I'm pouring a glass of wine down the sink. That was not me. Something had changed inside of me. I had been touched. Something had been there. And what the beauty of it was that I was now so tired, so exhausted, so given up. My fists were at my side that I could finally hear God's love for me, which was, Sharon, you don't need to live like this anymore. I didn't hear Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody came and surrounded me with a big book and, you know, put the coffee on. It was just, I was really getting ready to be here. And a guy that I had known from that bar, Barney's Beanery, said I could stay with him because they caught these guys. I had to go to court. And I was a victim of violent crime. It was a big thing. And I was above the liquor store, sipping on red wine through the broken jaw. And I called my mother because he said I had to leave. It was August 20th. And I called my mom, and my mom has never been to Al-Anon, but she's got a spiritual life. And she said to me, Sharon, I can't help you. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? And if my mother would have sent $20, you would have another speaker, and that's seconds and inches. And I called a number that was sitting there, and it was that girl, Chris. Her number was just sitting there in front of me. It could have been turned over. It was sitting there, and I called Chris, and Chris recognized alcoholism. And she said, you know, I can't help you, but Suzanne can. I was just trying to find a place to stay. That's all. And Suzanne was sober 5 years in the Pacific group. Chris was not sober that day. She knew she couldn't 12-step me. And she goaded me into calling this woman Suzanne. And I called Suzanne, and I can't talk. I have to talk like this. Because the first 3 months I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was wired shut. Jaw was wired shut. It was a blessing. Aww. Cold and cruel. No, truly, I had to learn to listen. But the joy that was this woman, Suzanne, said, don't drink anything, don't smoke anything either, and we'll pick you up. And I put my joint down. I thought, how does she know? You know? She read my mail. I sat on the steps of that liquor store with my broken Huarache shoes. My jeans were ripped, my bleach-stained T-shirt. My face was crooked. I had these wires. I hadn't bathed in a while. I didn't know where I'm going. Just two girls are coming to get me, and there they were. This bright yellow Volkswagen. I couldn't even look at it. It hurt, you know? And then they get out, and their teeth are huge, and they're just so bright. And all the time they're walking towards me, I'm going, no. No, I'm not going anywhere. And I just, the beauty of it was I was just so tired. I just let them pick me up and take me. And I don't know where we went or what we were doing, but it seemed all they did was talk incessantly about themselves. I had this little newspaper clipping from the Palm Spring Herald I carried in my pocket for, I don't know, weeks, thinking somebody would say, oh, my God, what happened to you? But they were just going, oh, she looks surrendered. Maybe she'll make it. You know, they were happy to see me looking like that. I mean, I didn't know how you knew I was new. I had no idea. I hadn't bathed. That was a clue. I was detoxing. I detoxed in the rooms. I smelled for a long time. You know, we've had a lot of people detox and get better and come in. They work all the steps in a week and come in and, you know, and you don't know they're new sometimes, you know. And the other month at our big meeting on Wednesday night, one of my babies ran up to me and said, oh, my God, somewhere over there smells like alcohol. What do I do? It was like, well, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, so... Maybe they want to get sober. Let's go find them. And I went over there and I just, oh, I love that smell. It's like Tiffany perfume. Oh, love that smell. Yeah. Where are they? I can smell them in the room. It was great. So that's what happened to me. I ended up at this church meeting and I kept waiting for them to, what's your potential? Why have you ended up this way? Sign here. You know, you're going to have to pay for your mantra, but you know, and I just kept waiting for something. I didn't know I was at AA. I just know that this man stuck out his hand and said, welcome. And nobody had said that to me in an awful long time. And this man gave me a big book, and then they said about what it costs, and I didn't want to owe you anything. I had one quarter in my pocket, and I gave Maurice a quarter. And you know what? I paid Maurice off one quarter at a time. He said you were the only newcomer that year who bought their book, who actually paid it off. But I didn't know. I didn't know at the beginning on a brand new life. I had no idea. I know that the man who spoke said he waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. And I identified. And that's all I remember of my first meeting. I remember they took me back and they wouldn't let me out of the car and they talked about themselves again. And their sponsors had said, now take her home, but wait for the liquor store lights to turn off before you send her upstairs. And that's love in action. I did not smell good. I couldn't talk. You didn't know what I was going to do. But they sat there and they 12-stepped me until I turned off the liquor store lights and then they sent me upstairs. And that's, they did that over and over and over again. And that's love in action. I hope I never drive a car that's too nice to have somebody vomit in. You know, I hope I never forget the kindness that was shown to me on that day. If I would have shown up at someplace else, maybe they would have gone, oh, it's nice to see you. We'll see you here next week, dear. Have a nice week, you know. But they said, we'll pick you up tomorrow night. Don't drink and use in between. Now, it was that simple, and for some reason I heard them. And I didn't drink and use in between, and they picked me up. And there I was, starting my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, not even being an alcoholic. I only got a sponsor because this guy with a tattooed tear who had the cup washing commitment with me wouldn't leave me alone until I got one. And then I went home and I looked at all these numbers that they had given me, and somebody had written something other than their name, and I thought, well, maybe she's nice, I'll ask her. And by now I had been sleeping on people's floors, and I got a sponsor and I moved up to her couch. It was a step up. It was something to be said for getting a sponsor. And it was that simple for me. And she made me hit my knees at night because I was in her house. She said, I want you to say a prayer every night on your knees. And I just prayed to this sleeping bag, this borrowed sleeping bag, for a long time, waiting for God to throw that lightning bolt. And I would say it real quick, and she'd have to write down the prayer for me because I couldn't remember it. Thank you for all you've given me. Thank you for all you've taken away from me. Thank you for all you've left me. And then I'd pop into bed, you know, waiting for the lightning bolt. And, you know, I was starting my sobriety. This lady named June Ann used to drag me around daytime meetings, nighttime meetings. And I had this broken jaw, and she would stand me by the coffee pot and make people shake my hand. And she loved to take me to Beverly Hills meetings looking like that. And here's the newcomer. It's like, yeah, we can tell. But June Ann, you know, we had these commitments together, and one night, you know, we got early because she was the cookie girl, and so then she went off to buy the cookies, and we're waiting for her to come back. She didn't come back, didn't come back. I was like, where's June Ann? The meeting's, you know, if you don't have cookies, you know, get an appointment, commitment, cookies, coffee, they'll miss you. And she didn't come back, and all of a sudden the LAPD pulled up, and you know, this man gets out, this cop, and he comes up to the door, and he's got this bag, and he hands us this bag of cookies. And we said, well, where's June Ann? He said, oh, she's in the car. She convinced me to bring you the cookies. She shoplifted some candy bars, so I got to take her in, but here's the cookies. So, you know, I learned something about commitment that night, you know? No matter what. And I remember being cookie girl at Ohio Street, and I would make big peace signs, and I would actually go to the grocery store and spend an hour, you know, trying to figure out, oh, let's see, Clint likes these cookies, and I'm not mad at him this week, so I'll get his cookies. And Chuck yelled at me last week, so he's not getting his Fig Newtons this week. And power. I mean, it was just so much power, you know. But they go through the line, take their coffee, grab a cookie. Nobody even pays attention, you know, but life was so intense. And God bless my sponsor, Janet, because she was so good for me. She was an angry woman that had learned how to live in the world, and I didn't know I was so angry. I didn't know I was such a victim. Thank God for Janet. I mean, she laughed like a duck. Quack, quack, quack. She wore all these long fingernails, and she didn't match anywhere of these fluorescent colors, but I could always spot her in the room. I mean, she was little, but she was bright, you know. And she was on to me. I didn't get that about her. Before I could finish a sentence, she was on to me. And the joy of sponsorship is, you know, you'll tell them over and over and over again, and they just, you don't hear till you hear, you don't see till you see, as Chuck C used to say. And you know, when I was sponsoring somebody, I was just on to Beth about this over and over and over again, and she just couldn't seem to hear it. And then one night the phone rings at 11 at night. She's home from a meeting. She says, guess what I heard at the meeting? You know, she's repeating what I had been talking about for a couple of months. And, you know, it's just, thank God she heard. You know, I just kind of looked up and I said, thank you. You know, thank you. Because all we are here is just, you know, we're God with skin on. You know, we really are, and I need to come and rub up to it and be reminded of it. And sponsorship is one of the most beautiful ways to be a link in the chain. I've got a sponsor and I sponsor, you know. And like I said, if you're bored with Alcoholics Anonymous, you're boring. Get going. There's so much to do here. There's so much to do here. But I was a pretty sicko, and I got this waitress job after the wires came off, and I got this $24 a week room and a teddy bear and telephone, and I bought insurance from Hank J, sold me my car insurance, and he's still getting a check from me today. I saw the same insurance company, and I felt really good. I felt really good. And then I went and got my car painted, and then I picked it up, and it was the wrong color, and I'm at the payphone. You know, and I never knew the story about Bill and the bar, but on the one side is the restaurant where I'm working, the other side is the bar, and I'm thinking, screw those people, I'm just gonna go have a drink. You know, life isn't fair, and I think about how I almost got drunk over a color of a car. You know, you wouldn't ever have known me. I would never have known you. And it just was one of those come on midnight days, but what I did was call my sponsor. And after about 5 minutes, we were laughing and figuring out how to make it, you know, less turquoise. And now it's in, you know, but this car, I had to put a chair behind the seat to hold me up because I would drive like this. So I got an old chair, and then I would drive like this, and I got my first traffic ticket. And, you know, I'd driven drunk coast to coast. I got my first traffic ticket. You know, then I'm irate. It's like, ugh, come on, you know. Then I had a hit and run. There goes the car off the street. And I had done that a few times. So it was just like, okay, maybe the slate's even now. And I am Boy Meets Girl on AA campus. And I met this guy, and he has 6 months more sobriety. And Janet walked by me one night as we're joined to the hip after the meeting, me and him, and she says, you better get your own God or you're going to get drunk. And I thought, she's embarrassing me. I'm talking to these new people here, and I'm sharing with them all of my wisdom. You know, I'm 9 months sober or something. And so I said, okay, Janet, come here. How about Beacon's moving van? There was a Beacon's truck parked there, and I explained to her how it was like an old dresser that had been moved from place to place because I took geographics, but God wrapped me in those quilty things, and you know, maybe the knob is off and it's all scratched and the leg and it's all, but it made it to the destination. Alcoholics Anonymous, all the newcomers are, yeah, I get it, you know. And she's standing with her hand on her hip with her little hip stuck out, she liked to do. And she said, good, as long as it's not you. And she walked on by. I thought, oh, I'll pray to Beacons for the rest of my life, you know. And today, even today when I see a Beacons truck, I just go, I'm going to be okay. You know, it just makes me feel better. People call me and say, I saw a Beacon's truck, just want to say hello, how are you doing, you know? So it's a good connection. But, you know, then I started sponsoring this nun. That was a long story. She asked me, I went, who are you talking to, you know? And guess what she has every year? A school carnival. Guess how I got to make amends for ripping off children? buying ride tickets every year and working with the nuns on this carnival every year. And my son ended up going to her school, and life just got good. And, you know, I had this baby in 1984, and I was sponsoring people, and I was involved in service work, and my jobs got better, and I had gone home to my dad, and I had made those amends, and I had sat with my mom, and my dad and I were still like this, but he had come and walked me down the aisle, and slowly things got a little bit better. But, you know, he just said he always wanted me to be happy, that was all. And nobody hugged, and nobody, I mean, I remember looking at the ground, making amends to my father at a year of sobriety. I still felt so guilty and just bad for all the pain I had caused him now that I'm sober and looking back. But it slowly got better. And he came to AA, and he came to a meeting and bought the big book. You know, my dad is an incredible reader, and he read it. I know. And they talked about AA when I come home like that. But then pretty soon they started to see a change. And as the children of my parents' friends are dying of alcoholism, they're talking, you know, our daughter's sober and AA, there's a way. You know, they're talking now. It's something they're proud of. Because they see what you've done with me. My mother can sleep at night because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if just for that alone, I'm overpaid. My mother doesn't have to worry about the phone ringing knowing they found me somewhere. I have animals in my life. I have a great life because I've been making my amends to the animal kingdom. I mean, all those dogs, those cats, my turtles, one crawled, you know, one made it, one didn't through the pile of cocaine and, you know, and had a smile on his face. He was a little stiff, but, you know, he was happy and buried him with a spoon and, So now my animals are spoiled rotten, totally spoiled rotten. And there's ways to make amends for absolutely everything if you're willing. And that first, that first time through the steps with Janet was so great. And, you know, even the first third step, I mean, she just was so happy and she just wouldn't stop hugging me. And it felt so good. And I just thought, God, stop hugging me. You know, get your face out of me. Just quit hugging me. And then I started to feel warm and good about it. And I thought I must be gay. That must be why I'm feeling so good for hugging me. I was so absolutely cut off from my emotions, I had no idea what I was. I was like an old computer, and the wires would go together slowly. And the night I hit my husband on the head with a flashlight, as it came up, the light bulb went on. Oh, I'm angry. You know? I went and called my sponsor. She said, good, we can start on your defects now, because we've been working on his for a long time. And slowly but surely, I began to know who I was, and I was able to work with this sponsor. And it... You know, 5 years of sobriety, I got this woman named Jenny, and Jenny was so good for me, and she helped me learn to be a woman again, and I was so afraid of that. I didn't think I could be enough of a woman. I didn't know about if I could cut it. And And then I got pregnant, and my son was born, and that was after some Al-Anon, because my ex decided to, he's my ex now, but he decided to go to punk rock concerts, and, you know, I had to go to Al-Anon. I didn't know how to release. I knew how to reject. And because I think of Al-Anon, our marriage stayed together, and I got this beautiful baby boy because our marriage stayed together for a little while longer, you know, because this child is definitely through me. You know, he's definitely through me. And Alcoholics Anonymous afforded me an incredible life. And 10 years of sobriety, that man decided he wanted someone else in the room, and she was new, and she was into punk rock, and they just, I don't know, all, they, you know. They pogoed off into the sunset, I guess. I don't know. Slam danced or something. And I just stood back, and I couldn't hang on his leg anymore. As he's going out the door, I had to let go. Alcoholics Anonymous had taught me how to loosen my grip. You know, had taught me how to loosen my grip and have some worth as a human being. At 7 years of sobriety, from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes, I stood at our home group and took my birthday cake, and I felt this rush of life through me that I had never felt before in my life, a completeness, maybe much like the first couple times I drank. And I felt whole again, and I felt loved by God again, and the innocence came back. And who would have ever thought that the innocence could have come back into my life? It was a total gift from God. Those magical, mystical moments that we all have by hanging on to the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous a day at a time to come here and to be with others, you can't buy those. You can't go out anywhere and buy those. It's a total gift that's been given to you. And I had to let them go, and my sponsor had, Ginny, with 21 years, had smoked pot. And I had to go get a new sponsor, and I picked her up at the airport, and she said, I have 21 days. And I ended up at Clancy's door with my baby in a stroller, and that day, because I knew I needed a sponsor right at that moment. I didn't care for him much. I don't think he cared for me much, but he was in my group, and he knew my history, and I said, I need help, and he said, sure, we'll try, and we've been trying now for almost 15 years, and, you know, he is louder than my head, and thank God that year he was, because I was crazy. I was crazy, but he was louder than my head, and the night I went over to them with two hot cups of coffee, him and her, they looked so happy that night. And I was going to throw a little coffee their way, but he saw me, and he stopped me, and he took the coffee out of my hand. He said, Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example to others. If he would have stopped at dignity and grace, I would have said, who cares? I want revenge. So you can be an example to others. And I became more into my life and my program and my newcomers, and I left him alone. And at their baby's first year birthday party, he said, you will go and you will take your son, because he wants to go to his half-brother's birthday. And so I bought the gift on sale and wrinkled up the paper, but I showed up. I showed up. And I stayed in the kitchen the whole day, and I still see pictures of that day that my son was with his brother on his first birthday. And I'm so glad that my sponsor had me be bigger than my feelings. The actions have set me free, not my head, not my thoughts, not my waiting around to be inspired. Actions have set me free. I used to think freedom's another word for nothing left to lose. I had nothing left to lose. I didn't understand any of the paradoxes of life or how to live life. And I found out that freedom is the actions that we take in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I put my head on the pillow at night, even if I've had a bad day, I've tried to be a better person. I've tried to be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you're looking or not. And God knows that. You know, my God loves me so much, I can't even imagine. I got to be good friends with her, and, you know, she is my best friend today. We call each other every other day. I mean, who would have thunk it, really? But, you know, they've been divorced a few years, so we've been better friends now. It's worked out that way. She told me when he left her that I was her example of walking through it with dignity and grace. So I don't know. I'm thrown in the swamp of alligators. My job is just to keep swimming, you know. It's not up to me. Sometimes you get to find out why, and sometimes you don't. You know, it's not my job. My job is just to show up and be of service. Page 77 is truth. To fit myself to be of service, maximum service to God and the people about me. When I saw that in the book, it's like, who put that in there? Wow, that is truth. And that's what I try to live by. It's really very simple. I want to let you know that my life is great today. I have my struggles. I've been at a job for 13 years. It's a law firm. It's interesting. And there's a lot of politics, and I try to just be of service. And you know, it affords me an incredible life with my child, and I get to send my son to Catholic schools, and I get to sponsor this nun, and I get to sponsor the ex-nun, and I get to sponsor a lot of women. I've got two beautiful women sitting here that are with me this weekend. You know, I can't go anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous without a hug from an old friend now, and make a new friend. And my Christmas list just gets bigger and bigger, what a testimony to Alcoholics Anonymous. I could probably get in my car and have a cup of coffee in every state. And every state, sit down and have a meeting with one of you in every state. I just love what we have here. I want to be a strong link in the chain of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you about my dad, because making those amends to my father allowed me to stand up straight and tall around the male population. I never knew that that was something that was kind of still missing inside of me. And that sponsor, Jenny, God love her, she had me, she's sober almost 5 years now, by the way, she's back again. And what happened was, she had me call my dad and ask him if I could pay him back the money I owed him. And I argued about that, because I didn't know that she knew about the bail bondsman and the lawyer and the bounce checks and the credit cards. And I called him up and I said, "Dad, you know, I'm going to make this amends, Steph." And he said, "Good, it's this much." And he gave me a figure. He didn't have to wait at all for that. And he had read the book, and he had run a calculator tape, and he had said to my mom, "If Sharon stays sober, she'll get to this part of the book, and if I'm not home when she calls, here it is circled in red. At the bottom of page, I guess 79, it says, 'Most alcoholics owe money,' and he's a Capricorn, and that's just the way he is." And so I called him, and he gave me a figure, and I called my sponsor back, and I said, "He was too quick, and it's too high." And she said, "Well, good. Now we can get started. Now you're really willing to grow through this, and I hope you have a sponsor that wants more for you than you think you can have." Because she had me do something I would have never thought to do. With that check, she had me write a note about my life. "Don't send him the cold, hard cash. Send him a little of you." And so my dad got that check and that note for 4 years plus. And he called me between Christmas and New Year's. He said, "Merry Christmas, Sharon. I don't want your debt. You know, your debt is free and clear. It's done. No more checks from you, but don't stop sending me your notes." And my dad and I got to walk into a guilt-free relationship because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of wonderful sponsorship and people I believed. And on April 19th last year, my father was killed in an accident on his land. And when I got the call, you know, I thought, it's not fair. I didn't get to say goodbye, you know. We had a lot of years of being together. We had a lot of years of my father sharing with me his feelings. And at one point, I thought, we were having this intimate discussion. I thought, was going to share my program back with him and, you know, sponsor him a little. And but thank God my God said, "Just shut up and listen." And so for a lot of years, I just shut up and listened to my dad share with me. And I said to somebody, "I ain't gonna say goodbye." And she said, "Sounded like you had a lot of hellos, you know." And it's just the perspective we put on Alcoholics Anonymous. It's absolutely the perspective we put on Alcoholics Anonymous with each other. And I got to be home from my mom, and the family showed up, and it was, I got to write my dad one more note and give him my chip. Because, you know, we wouldn't have a relationship without you. And we had this wake for him, and it was raining, and the Chinese say when a good man dies, it rains, and it rained, it rained, it rained. My father, the whole town showed out, and people were in line, and they were going through and going, "Now, are you Nancy?" And I go, "God, no, I'm not Nancy. I'm, you know," it's like, "Thank you, sweetheart." Southern gentleman, I love it. And so, I don't know, I was losing perspective. There's my father's wake, and I'm beginning to think it's about me, and I had to go call my sponsor in the middle of this. I am not well. And I called Clancy at the mission. I went to the rectory, and he didn't pick up. He didn't pick up, and I hung up, and I called back, and I thought, he's got 60 seconds. He got on at 48. And I told him about, you know, this wake and that, how I was feeling, you know, and, you know, it's grief. You react a little, you know, thank God I know to keep my mouth shut and call my sponsor. And he said, you know, he brought me back to reality. I told him about the accordion number I was working on all day with my father's Heligonka and Czechoslovakian accordion and all these buttons, and I hadn't played an accordion in years, and this was the button, and it was different than mine, and I worked really hard on it. Amazing Grace, and I want to play this for my dad, and I'm going on and on and on. And he says, "Sharon, there won't be a dry eye in the house. Do it. Play it for your dad." I'm thinking, yeah, there won't be a dry eye in the house. He said, "But really look for the ones sobbing, because they'll be the musicians, you know." And that's my sponsor, yeah. He just brought me back to reality. This is your father's wake. Let's, you know, show up for your mother and show up for the rest of the family. And I got to play him a tune, and we all got to share, and it was a joyous, I mean, a testimony to my father. It's an incredible family that he raised, incredible family. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to go be of service to my mother. I get to be of service to my family. I have women in Iowa that I sponsor that get to go by and have my mom cook for them. And this last weekend, I got to celebrate my mother's 80th birthday at a conference in Des Moines and be with her and watch you spoil her and watch you fawn over her. And I was so proud. I was so proud of who you are. On a daily basis, I try to enlarge my spiritual life, and it's pretty simple, really. I have a great relationship with Casey. He tells y'all hello. He wishes he could be here. He's working, and we've been together 13 years, and nobody's moved their clothes in, and that's okay. I've been raising this great 16-year-old kid. 16, get that. Yeah, he's 16. But he's a giver and a big, generous spirit, and he loves Alcoholics Anonymous, and he loves what you've done with your mom. And so far, there's no signs. He's a normal kid, and he's in Hawaii. With a new girlfriend, so we'll see. It's funny, he sat on his cell phone on the beach yesterday, and I had this long message at home, somebody lost a towel. I could hear all this. He didn't know that he called me with his cell phone. So I called him, and I said, "Hi, Wes, how are you?" He said, "Fine, Mom, having a good time." He said, "Hey, who lost their towel?" And he goes, "How do you know, Mom? How do you always know all these things?" I said, "Because you're dealing with the master. Don't ever forget it." But my life is real simple today. I show up. I try to be of service. I have my prayers with my God at night, and I put my head on the pillow. But every morning I have this great little dog who puts her face on my bed. She thinks I'm terrific no matter what. She puts her face on my bed, and she says, "Good morning, I love you." You know, and as Charlotte tells me, you know what dog spelled backwards is. And I take my dog for a walk, and she just thinks I'm terrific. And my prayers are real simple. God, please let me be half the person that my dog thinks I am. And if I can just do that, I'm a success today. So be a strong link in the chain of Alcoholics Anonymous. Be a giver here. Know that it's a precious gift, and know that I am so pleased to be back in your presence and feel the love of Atlanta. Thank you very much for having me.